and welcome to Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, coming to you live from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan and Sudan this Thursday, September 12, 2024. The fate of South Sudan's transitional period hangs in a limbo.
But now, if the president is going to make a decision, how do they expect our opinion to be balanced?
And some political parties in eastern Equatorial State say they are confused about South Sudan's December elections.
That's why you see most of the political leaders, they have not come up with their leaders who is going to contest with Salva Kiir. The time may not be enough for the community or people of South Sudan to make a right decision.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Stakeholders to the 2018 peace agreement have drafted a document on the faith of the country's roadmap for extending the transitional period. The Minister of Cabinet Affairs, Martin Elia Lumuro, says some provisions of the deal have yet to be implemented, but proposals of the review committee provide solutions. A South Sudan politician complains that very few politicians contribute on national matters. For VOA News, Dennis Logonyi reports from Juba.
Parties to the 2018 peace agreement drafted a document highlighting some progress and challenges in implementing the deal to resolve the conflict in South Sudan. Elia Lumuro, Minister of Cabinet Affairs and the Secretary of the Committee charged with monitoring progress of the agreement, says the recommended solutions for implementing the agreement are nonpartisan.
On the basis of our analysis, assessment and observations, we have made recommendations to the presidency. And these recommendations are strictly technical, based on the technical reports that we have received from the institutions that are concerned with election. Whatever decision that will be made by the extended meeting of the presidency, which will include the heads of various political parties, will be a technical decision and not a political decision.
Gabriel Kwot Akok, leader of the People's Progressive Party, says the recommendation should be made available to the public.
The government is not caring about the public opinion. They just decide what they think fits for them. I wish this report had been shared with the members of the public, politicians, journalists, and everyone. Say that we have an opinion before the president make a final decision. But now, if the president is going to make a decision, how do they expect our opinion to be balanced?
Lumuro says the recommendations will, in his words, prepare the country for peaceful, fair, and transparent elections.
Our commitment is to ensure that we maintain the peace that we have achieved under the Araxes, and that we carry the country forward until the people of South Sudan vote for their leaders. That is the commitment that we as a committee have got, and we are here to support the leadership, the presidency, which will sit and make a final decision.
Peter Malir is an activist who says South Sudanese should only expect an extension from the presidency because the parties to the agreement have done very little to implement the agreement.
There is no other solution but to have a decision to extend. You have the Tumaini, which have to be incorporated in the governance of the R-axis, and then you have the unfinished process, including the National Unified Forces, which are very important elements for both security and including elections. So there are quite a number of things that will clearly say that there is definite extension and there is definite cancellation of the elections.
South Sudan's roadmap for the implementation of the 2018 peace agreement is supposed to end with elections in December of this year, but some pending tasks in the deal may push the deadline for elections into next year. President Salva Kiir and his five deputies are expected to make a decision on the fate of the December 2024 elections and the transitional period soon. Some foreign diplomats, South Sudanese political activists and political parties have expressed concern that the timeline for election preparations is not realistic. For VOA News, I'm Dennis Logonyi reporting from Juba.
From Juba, we move to Torit on the same story, where some political parties in eastern Equatorial State say they are ready for a December election. They say their candidates are ready to run for various state and national seats across the country. The group is urging Electoral Commission to provide time frame so that South Sudanese can have enough time to decide on their choices of candidates in the December polls. For VOA News, Kaltuma Vanessa reports from Torit.
South Sudan was supposed to hold election last year towards the end of the transition, but the country's transition period was extended to September 22, 2024. Taban Oliver, a member of the group known as Other Political Party, says his party is waiting to participate in the election despite the fast approaching time for the December election.
You cannot get a leader without having a convention. We'll also have our convention, and in our convention we'll get our leaders, and then from there we'll also have other members who will be representing community in the state and in the National Legislative Assembly. Yeah, but because we still see the environment is not safe, that's why you see most of the political leaders, they have not come up with their leaders who is going to contest with South Africa. The time may not be enough for the community or people of South Sudan to make a right decision. And that will be the challenge when it is decided.
Kokol Michael, spokesperson for South Sudan People Liberation Movement in opposition in Eastern Equatorial State, says South Sudan needs a constitution before holding a national election. Nevertheless, he says his party is prepared to participate in elections.
All of us are going to contest, including me. Even me, I'm ready to go and contest with some opponents who are coming from other parties. But the condition is that we just need this thing to be finished. I will declare myself and start even contesting or start going for campaign. All of us are ready. Even those who will be going for presidency will be seen that day. Even at the stadium, you will see others are going for governorship. We have candidates available for all the positions up to the local level. We are very ready, 100%. Just only these prerequisites which need to be done.
Musa Albino Oyani from the South Sudan Opposition Alliance also confirmed the readiness of the umbrella group to participate in the December elections.
In the agreement, there should be 6 months for preparation before election is conducted, but now it's only 3 months to election. So there may be something that we don't know, because if there was election, the change will show in the government so that people will see and know what to do. We didn't get any update from the national to know whether there is elections or not.
The South Sudan People Liberation Movement loyal to President Salva Kiir have openly endorsed him as the party flag bearer. Peter Mayen Majondit of the People's Liberal Party also declared his candidacy for the country's top seat. The election has been postponed several times after the 2013 conflict in South Sudan. In 2011, the South Sudan Parliament voted to extend the presidential and parliamentary term until 9th July 2018. It was later postponed again to 2021. A transitional period of 3 years was agreed to by the signatories, followed by an election that was to be held in 2023. But the transitional government of National Unit agreed instead to move the election to December 22, 2024. For VOA News, I am Kaltuma Vanessa reporting from Eastern Equatorial State Capital, Torit.
Still on issues to do with elections, a week ago, participants at the Kenya-led South Sudan Peace Talks, also known as the Tumaini Initiative, predicted that an agreement could be signed by September 16. First Vice President Riek Machar, a key partner, withdrew from the talks on July 16. Daniel Akech is the International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. The group has just published an advisory on the Tumaini Initiative. Akech tells my colleague James Batty the stakes are high for South Sudan and that an agreement or election will not solve all the country's problems.
I don't think it's a normal procedure for the parties negotiating to know when they will sign an agreement in advance, because it has to involve talking and agreeing on things. The parties negotiating in Nairobi are the coalition governments that signed the 2018 peace agreements that involved the president's party, Machar's party, and other parties. Within that coalition, Machar walked out of the negotiations in mid-July 2024, and he hasn't come back yet. So even if the parties were to go ahead and sign anything in this foreseen date of September 16, it would not really have much value.
Let me ask you, therefore, what do you see as the possible implications if there is no deal between President Kiir and Riek Machar?
One of the problems is that there are three dilemmas facing South Sudan as we speak now, one of which is the elections that are supposed to take place in December. The decisions on dissolving the governments before the elections are meant to happen at least 3 months before the election date. And if the election date is December 22nd, Machar and the president should agree on dissolving the government, some aspect of the government, and go for elections preparations by September 22nd. So it looks like this is a bit too late for that to happen. The third option is for the parties to actually use the Tumaini initiative in Nairobi to extend the agreements. And once they have done that, they will likely postpone the December polls. So if that is not an option, elections cannot happen because the government is incapable of actually organizing elections within the next 3 months, then the option is for Machar and Kiir to agree to do their own extension of the agreement, postponements of elections in Juba. That is pretty remote. So I think if they don't agree, Nairobi is likely going to be the case that not much could be done in Juba. And that means we will walk into next year with lots of problems, potential for violence if these uncertainties remains unresolved.
Also hanging in the balance as we talk about a possibility of a deal is whether South Sudan will be able to hold election at the end of this year.
Even if there is a deal or no deal, everyone is saying that it's a bit too late now for the country to go for elections. We're talking of 3 months away. There are lots of obstacles that have not been addressed. One of the foremost of the obstacles is the merging of the forces that is splintered when the conflicts happened in 2013. These forces are all over. The parties that are supposed to contest in elections cannot contest as long as they have forces under their commands. And now in South Sudan, we do not have a single commander-in-chief. The second obstacle is the absence of voter registrations. So those are big obstacles that cannot be solved within 3 months.
Do you think South Sudan will continue to enjoy the support of the international community and also the East African community in case there is no deal or no election by the end of this year?
Thank you, James, for these questions. South Sudan has not been doing very well with the transitions, and there is lots of expectations from the leaders to, if they go for further extensions, there should be a clear signals to the rest of the world and to the regions and to the citizens inside South Sudan that these new extensions will be different, that actually the extension for agreements are not used to prolong the stay in power by the top elites. Without doing that, it's going to be difficult to convince the regions to get involved or to actually help the South Sudanese government.
That's Daniel Akech, International Crisis Group's senior analyst for South Sudan. He spoke with my colleague James Batty from Nairobi. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the UN renews arms embargo on Sudan. Find out why after this break. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. On Wednesday, the UN Security Council unanimously voted to extend sanctions against Sudan for another year. This resolution renewed the 1591 Sudan sanctions regime, including travel bans and an arms embargo. Paul Ndiho has more from Washington.
I shall put the drafters.
The United Nations Security Council has extended the Sudanese sanctions regime, including measures such as asset freezes, travel bans, and an arms embargo until September 12, 2025. The decision was made by unanimously adopting a draft resolution, a technical rollover of measures previously renewed by Resolution 2676 in March 2023. Speaking after the vote, the U.S. Representative Robert A. Wood emphasized the importance of sanctions renewal.
Renewing the sanctions measures will restrict the movement of arms into Darfur and sanction individuals and entities contributing to or complicit in destabilizing activities in Sudan. All of this is critical to helping end the escalating conflict.
Sudan's permanent representative said there is evidence that the war in the country is a result of the support of the UAE for militias that are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur.
There is irrefutable evidence that this war that we are experiencing is as a result of the support of the UAE for militias that are committing war crimes and crimes against humanity in Darfur.
UAE's representative to the United Nations, Mohamed Abushaba, refuted the claim and said the accusations were baseless and utterly false.
I am compelled to participate in this meeting to respond to the baseless allegations made earlier this morning by the Sudanese representative, who, as we all know, represents one of the warring parties, whose legitimacy to represent the people of Sudan is questionable, to say the least. His claims are utterly false and are a cynical attempt to deflect attention from the failings of the Sudanese armed forces.
Fighting erupted in Sudan in April 2023, beating the National Army led by General Abdel Fattah al-Burhani against the paramilitary rapid support forces of his former deputy, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. Aid groups say the fighting has prevented humanitarian supplies from reaching the 25 million Sudanese facing severe hunger. Upwards of half of the country's population faces acute food shortages. Paul Liho, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move to Harare, where Zimbabwe's government has introduced hefty fines of up to $5,000 for poor service in the country's telecommunication industry. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, where Zimbabweans are talking to social media celebrating the government's decision to allow Starlink to offer more affordable and better satellite internet service in a country that has one of the highest internet costs on the continent.
In a statement Tuesday, Zimbabwe's ICT Minister Tendai Mavetera said the government will levy fines of between $200 and $5,000 per infringement for telecommunications companies and internet providers who fail to give reliable service. Willard Shoko, an independent high-speed internet consultant, says the new fines could result in a solid telecom industry that can compete in the entire Southern African region.
The motive behind that is to improve internet for the end user, but I think they should also consider improving the infrastructure sharing and also collaboration to improve internet not only for the region, but also for Zimbabwe and the region as well, because this is the foundation of the digital economy. So I think they should also look at how the internet can be improved and the partnerships that can help improve the internet.
Fungai Mandibei, Media and Corporate Affairs Executive at Econet Wireless, Zimbabwe's biggest telecommunications company, said the new regulations will be easier to comply with than those that existed before.
The new provisions introduce a new model of penalties, unlike the blanket penalty that existed in the previous statutory instrument. The new penalties now are now linked to specific quality of service breaches that have also been clearly spelled out. There is now more clarity in defining what constitutes a quality of service breach and what penalty goes with a specific breach of the quality of service.
However, Christopher Musonza, an independent digital policy consultant, says the pressure to maintain internet service during Zimbabwe's frequent power outages may present challenges for telecom companies.
For the telecoms provider, it's going to be tough. The economy is not performing as anyone would want. We've got issues to do with long hours of load shedding. So telecom providers have to power their base stations for long hours to ensure that they meet the performance, the key performance indicators. So imagine running a generator for most of the day to ensure that you avoid a fine. I'm not sure what will cost more, trying to keep up with these economic factors or just paying the fine.
Zimbabweans have long complained about poor and expensive telecommunication service. Shoko says that is the reason why they are welcoming this month's approval of Starlink's license to operate in Zimbabwe.
They can now easily get internet access from anywhere in Zimbabwe at an affordable price, thereby bridging the digital divide. That's one major thing for the end user. For the local ISP in Zimbabwe, there's a massive opportunity that Zimbabwe can take an advantage of: investment in ground infrastructure. Currently in Africa, Nigeria has the only two ground stations that are servicing the whole of Africa. If Zimbabwe government and local ISPs can work together with Starlink to provide ground stations in Zimbabwe, this will allow local ISPs to provide internet to Starlink and provide better latencies in the region. So this will improve internet, Starlink internet, for local Zimbabweans as well as the region.
The US-based satellite company Starlink, owned by Elon Musk, has established a presence in several other African countries, including Botswana, Kenya, Mozambique, Nigeria, Rwanda, and Zambia. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare.
From Harare, we move back to the United States, where Vice President Kamala Harris joined President Joe Biden in commemorating the 23rd anniversary of the worst terror attack on American soil. Whoever takes the presidency in January, whether Harris or her rival former President Donald Trump, also at the ceremonies, he or she will continue to face a range of threats. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell reports from Ground Zero in New York.
It was here, on a cruelly beautiful September day, that the world changed. The worst terror attack in U.S. history started here, in 2001, with two hijacked planes smashing into New York City's iconic landmark, the World Trade Center Twin Towers. Less than an hour later, another airliner pierced the symbol of American military might, the Pentagon. And then again, that same terrible day, a final hijacked flight came to a tragic end here, in this desolate field in rural Pennsylvania. 23 September 11th later, President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris marked this somber day with silence, racing to all three sites, meeting privately with victims' families and first responders, and listening to the litany of names, hours worth of names, read one by one by victims' families. Joining them in somber silence and quieting the usual clatter of this fevered presidential campaign, presidential challenger Donald Trump and his running mate, J.D. Vance. They also met with families and first responders. Biden and Harris issued written statements on the tragedy. Responding to a question from VOA, the White House said the U.S. continues to take terror threats seriously. White House National Security spokesman John Kirby.
But as for counterterrorism capability, again, we have proven time and time again that we are able to monitor the threat and deal with the threat, sometimes in near real time, if need be. Not taking it for granted, not saying we don't always have to keep sharpening it, but believe me, we're focused on it.
But terrorism experts point to a growing list of hotspots, from the revitalized terror haven of Afghanistan to growing threats in West Africa. Jason Blazekas is a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies and an expert on terrorism. He spoke to us from Abuja, Nigeria.
We've seen a rise of ISIS-affiliated groups in West Africa, as well as a rise in Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups in West Africa. And we've seen some West African states have adopted authoritarian tones, have taken power by force, ignoring democracy and elections. And that has resulted in the departure of countries like the United States and France, who have embraced a rule of law system to counter bad actors.
Whoever wins the White House in November, he said, will also need to look at threats much closer to home.
I've been writing about the rise of domestic extremism for the last few years, and in many ways, it's the most profound challenge the United States faces. For a few reasons. First, there has been an explosion of polarization in the United States, putting politics aside, but politics is part of that polarization that we see, that has resulted in a rise, especially in the early 2020s, of groups that have neo-Nazi sympathies.
A whole generation of Americans has grown up since that terrifying, clarifying, clear-skied autumn day. But for the next commander-in-chief, there is never a time to breathe easy. Anita Powell, VOA News, in New York, Shanksville, Pennsylvania, and the Pentagon.
Vice President Kamala Harris and former President Donald Trump met for what could be their first and only presidential debate on Tuesday. The early numbers suggest that more than 60 million people tune in to watch the matchup. The race between the two candidates remains tight. VOA's Dora McQuarrie explores whether the debate changed people's minds about who to vote for.
Polls taken immediately after the presidential debate on Tuesday suggest Vice President Kamala Harris outperformed former President Donald Trump. But that isn't swaying either candidate's strongest supporters, like these Trump voters.
I know that under Trump, the economy was much better than it has been under Biden. I think his abortion issue comments was pretty strong.
Trump actually secured the border. Why should we have these criminals in our country invading and then basically polluting, harassing, and destroying our communities?
Or these Harris supporters.
I thought she was on fire. She was succinct. She was sure of herself. She spoke policy. She was positive when he was negative.
I am so glad that she is touching on some of the tough issues on the economy, on abortion, on immigration. These are the things that we need to continue to see progress on.
Some Trump supporters felt that the moderators, journalists from ABC News, were unfair to their candidate.
It seemed like they're fact-checking him, but not fact-checking her. So what she's saying is a lot of lying going on. I'm very frustrated by it.
We already knew what this debate was going to look like. It's favored one candidate than the other.
I'm a little frustrated because I think she's had a lot of airspace on things that Democrats are going to be super excited about.
Meanwhile, fans on both sides felt the vice president successfully goaded the former president.
Trump, you know, I think that he got baited a couple times with some of her personal jabs, like his rally sizes, people leaving his rally early. She brought that up, I thought, very strategically.
It's very clear that she's on her best game and that she's willing to take him on in a clear way.
Early signs suggest that neither candidate performed strongly enough to win over significant numbers of undecided voters, the very people who could decide the election.
I don't know how much it's going to move the needle for anybody that still hasn't made a decision yet. I thought they both had good moments, both had bad moments.
I feel like they're both not the right candidate for me, based on this debate and the past debates. Still, I'm still undecided.
There might not be another presidential debate to help him decide. While Harris's team is calling for another matchup, Trump says he is less inclined to debate Harris a second time. Dora McQuarrie, VOA News, Washington.
From politics, we now move to music, and we'll leave you with the song Premier Gao by Magic System, not Jackson. For more on our programs, visit www.voaafrica.com. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Bill Bass, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.